You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 8th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jacob Grumbach, professor at the University of Washington, author of Laboratories Against Democracy, How National Parties Transformed State Politics. Also on the program, Senate passes Build Back a Bit. And what some climate activists are calling, well, it's probably just objectively the biggest attempt to mitigate climate change by the U.S. government in its history. That was a low bar. Meanwhile, the Republicans were successful in removing a cap on the cost of insulin for anybody who is not covered under Medicare. Alex Jones hit with a $45 million in punitive damages over his Sandy Hook lies, and he's still got two more trials to go. Ceasefire in the Israeli assault on Gaza, leaving 44 Palestinians, 15 of whom are kids, dead. This as the IDF concedes it has used Palestinians as human shields. And its Supreme Court, the Israeli Supreme Court, says you can't do that anymore. Columbus, Ohio teachers authorize a strike. That UAW strike in Iowa hits a three-month mark. In UK, Amazon workers stage wildcat strikes. Petro, a former M19 guerrilla fighter, sworn in as Colombia's first leftist president. Iran and U.S. close in on that evasive nuke deal. Lastly, the killings of four Muslim men in Albuquerque sparked fear of a targeted serial killings. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. I am here with Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
Oh, great way to start off the week.
Yeah.
We're both here.
Nice.
Yep.
Good.
Folks, I took a personal day on Friday. I'm going to take another one this week. You know, just juggling stuff over the still in sort of like not a normal summer. Still like impacted by COVID a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
Both materially and also just sort of behaviorally. If that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. So, and you have kids, so more affected.
A little more affected in that respect. Although, just a reminder, we have almost 500 people a day dying in this country from COVID. The vaccine doesn't give you full protection against catching it, but it certainly heightens your ability to deal with it and keep you out of the hospital. So if you are one of, and I imagine we have one person listening to the program who has not gotten vaccinated, good idea to get vaccinated. Also, I'm also just sort of amazed. Like, I still wear my mask. It's not as intense as it was back in the day, but I still wear my mask when I go into, like, a store for a couple of minutes or, I don't know, going, well, certainly on the subway, but there are people I see who don't wear it on the subway even.
Yeah, that's a bridge too far for me.
I'm not sure I'm ever going to take off a mask on the subway unless I'm going for, you know, a long time. I'll take it off for a minute, move around a little bit, but...
Yeah. Hopefully that gets better as the colder months come, because I think people get hot in their mask and then they just get irritated and take it off.
Well, but, I am constantly irritated, so it doesn't affect me whatsoever. Okay.
People seem to be over masks, like anywhere you go indoors, like I would say you are in the, like, I'd say 25% of people still wear masks.
And yeah, we're here in New York.
I'm really surprised by that, but I mean, all right, suit yourselves. Let's get on with this. There's obviously a lot of things that are not in this bill that were in the original Build Back Better bill. And there's certainly goodies in there for the fossil fuel industry. Hopefully we're going to speak to someone tomorrow to get an assessment from a climate change perspective. But I think the easiest way to look at this is that we are paying a ransom as a country to the fossil fuel industry for them to allow us to transition away from fossil fuels.
And particularly to Manchin as well. So a pipeline can run through the over 1,000 wetlands and streams in West Virginia and pollute them there. He has given his constituents that privilege.
There you go. You're welcome. Now, and it's unclear. You know, a lot of times these things don't actually deliver. It's one thing to say, like, you can open up the leases for fossil fuel companies, but they got a ton of leases. The real question is, like, how much money can they make when they drill on these leases? And with the billions of dollars being poured into renewable energy, it's going to make their energy more expensive and less valuable. And so they may not ever use those leases. But again, it's basically like a bribe. And at the end of the day, doesn't look like we're going to hit the 50% mark that Biden had wanted in terms of dropping emissions by 2030. But supposedly it appears that we're going to hit the 40% mark. And again, that's pretty good.
Yeah. I agree with you. It's a net positive, but I do want to point out that a lot of this is tax credits and incentives as opposed to mandating of industry, which is what we really need to effectively combat climate change.
But we'll be talking to an expert on that. But here is Chuck Schumer, delivering the final speech before the Senate Democrats and Vice President Harris passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which, again, I mean, it's not going to impact inflation.
It's telling a kid who's having fruit, like, tastes just like candy, right?
Yeah.
Manchin on board.
It's not even almost like tastes like candy. It's like, it's candy.
Yeah.
Well, no, this is fruit. It's candy. It's more or less candy. But you know what? If it works, fine. Here is Chuck Schumer.
It's been a long, tough, winding road, but at last, we have arrived. I know it's been a long day and a long night, but we've gotten it done. Today, after more than a year of hard work, the Senate is making history. I am confident the Inflation Reduction Act will endure as one of the defining legislative feats of the 21st century. Our bill reduces inflation, lowers costs, creates millions of good-paying jobs, and is the boldest climate package in U.S. history. This bill will kickstart the era of affordable clean energy in America. It's a game changer. It's a turning point, and it's been a long time in coming. To Americans who've lost faith that Congress can do big things, this bill is for you. To seniors who face the indignity of rationing medications or skipping them altogether, this bill is for you. And to the tens of millions of young Americans who have spent years marching, rallying, demanding that Congress act on climate change, this bill is for you.
I mean, Schumer's pretty excited because now he can pretend like he never messed up and totally almost blew this entire thing. We should say the other part of this package, it's basically two things. Well, it's really three things. It is a climate package, which provides a ton of subsidies for renewable energy and promoting renewable energy. Also for communities that suffer from basically what comes down to environmental racism, right? Like where, you know, if you want to find a power station, just look to the most more marginalized community in any given town. That's where you'll find the power station. It also caps the price of drugs, or allows Medicare to negotiate for drugs starting in 2026, 10 drugs. After that, it starts increasing it. It caps the out-of-cost expenses for medication at $2,000 for seniors annually. It attempted to limit the price, or put a price control on insulin for people outside of Medicare. It was ruled out of order by the parliamentarian. It was kept in the bill, and then it was, and then Republicans passed a motion to get it out of the bill. I mean, Democrats could have ignored the parliamentarian in that instance. People suspect that maybe there'll be a bipartisan bill about insulin after this. That's, you know.
I mean, what did they get? 57 Republicans on board initially, so they'd need more than that. And if it's a standalone.
They had seven Republicans
on
board.
Sorry. Right, that's exactly what I mean to say. Yeah. Yeah. So
they needed 60. And to make it to pass it outside of the reconciliation rules.
I really doubt that McConnell's going to want to give Biden that win ahead of the midterms.
I would imagine not, but we'll see. And then there was also Sinema wanted to, you know, protect hedge fund people from having to pay the same amount of taxes that everybody else does. And so we ended up getting a minimum tax for corporations at 15%. I'm not quite sure on how effective that will be. I guess time will tell, and we'll get a sense of that. Also, funding for the IRS to get up to some like decent staffing levels so that they don't just basically let millionaires and billionaires walk away without paying any taxes. There was another bump on taxes, but basically that's the bill. And it is about, I don't know, maybe nine times smaller than the original one, or I should say the $3.5 billion one. But it is something. And relative to what we've done in terms of climate in this country, it is maybe more than something. But we'll talk to somebody who is an expert on this stuff in the coming days to make that assessment. Before we get to Professor Grumbach, who's written a book, Laboratories Against Democracy, a couple words from our sponsors today. One of our sponsors, ZBiotics, which is a coincidence because this morning I was like, I got to get more of that stuff. ZBiotics is a probiotic drink. It breaks down the byproduct of alcohol. This is the thing that I learned from this. I always assumed the reason why you felt bad the next day after you drink, and some people are more sensitive than others, but like I am definitely not at 100%, even if I just have one drink the night before. Fortunately for me, I operate around 120% generally. So I can diminish my functioning by 25% and still be at 95%. But for most people, that's not the case.
Okay.
I just made that up.
I don't even know.
Well, the point is, I thought it was dehydration, and it's not. Alcohol creates a sort of toxic, a toxic byproduct in your gut. And ZBiotics, you drink one bottle of it. It's about this size, small. It's like not even a shot.
Yeah.
And before you drink any alcohol, one bottle is all you need for the night. Doesn't matter whether you're having one drink or a bunch of them. And, you know, you drink responsibly, you pace yourself, you know, you're grown up, you get a good night's sleep, and then you wake up the next morning and you feel good. You want to work out? You work out. You want to work or host a podcast? You do that. Like I said, there's a toxic byproduct of alcohol. It builds up in an unprepared gut, and it causes you to feel terrible the next day. Well, Z-Biotics produces an enzyme, sort of like the one that your liver uses. It breaks down this byproduct, and Z-Biotics is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It's created by altering the DNA of a natural probiotic bacteria that we eat all the time. Z-Biotics is not vitamins. It's not plant extract. It's no off-the-shelf ingredients. Z-Biotics has been rigorously tested and is FDA compliant for safety. If you're the kind of person who enjoys, you know, I don't know, going and having a drink with a friend, you know, particularly on the weekdays, or, you know, you're like old school, come back from work and have your partner make you a drink,
right?
So that you can relax at cocktail hour. Z-Biotics is perfect for you. So check it out. You get 15% off your first order of Z-Biotics pre-alcohol probiotic. Go to zbiotics.com/majority. Use the code majority. That's the letter Z, biotics, biotics.com/majority. Coupon code majority at checkout saves you 15%. The link is in the YouTube and the podcast description as always. Meanwhile, you also need to take care of yourself as someone who is getting up in years, myself. I've started to take supplements because my body needs all sorts of vitamins.
Mm-hmm.
And it's super important to understand, like, you know, what exactly you're putting into your system. Well, Ritual is creating a new standard with its first of its kind visible supply chain. So you can literally see where each labeled ingredient in your vitamins comes from down to its supplier. So your vitamin D, it's from the UK. Or your omega-3 DHA comes from microalgae in Canada. Plus, all of Ritual science-backed vitamins are clean, vegan-certified, and third-party tested. So you can trust what you're putting into your body. And now's the chance to get 3-in-1 gut support with Ritual's revolutionary 3-in-1 capsule. It is clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotic to support a balanced gut microbiome. These probiotics help relieve mild and occasional discomforts, like maybe bloating or gas or, God forbid, diarrhea. Check out Ritual's plant-based protein from regeneratively farmed peas. It's got a beautiful vanilla flavor, has no chalkiness, and is designed for specific life stages to support muscle growth. That becomes important when you get into my life stage, which is like exclusively muscle diminishment.
Muscle mush.
Yeah, exactly. But I take my over 50 now? I can't remember. I'm older than the over number, which Ooh. Is a little bit scary. But it's helpful, and my doctor has said, like, I don't get reports. I go to the doctor now. Your vitamin D is down. I don't get that.
Good.
It's good. It's important. These are supplements you can trust taking. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months when you visit ritual.com/majority to start your ritual today. That's ritual, ritual.com/majority. Check it out. Again, we'll put that link in the podcast and YouTube description. Don't forget, it's your support that keeps this show going. You can help the Majority Report survive and thrive by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free half free of commercials, you also get the fun half. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jacob Grumbach, author of Laboratories Against Democracy, How National Parties Transformed State Politics. We are back. Sam Cedar and Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I want to welcome to the program Jacob Grumbach. He is a professor at the University of Washington, author of Laboratories Against Democracy, How National Parties Transformed State Politics. Professor, thanks so much for joining us. Let's just start with your title. I want to say an aficionado, but I'm a fan of Louis Brandeis.
Yeah.
Probably my favorite Supreme Court justice. And you took your title from something that he had famously said, but tweaked it ever so much that really turned it to something sort of much darker. Let's talk about that.
Exactly. So Louis Brandeis coined the phrase laboratories of democracy. And the idea there was states were going to serve as these sort of policy laboratories doing policy experiments, right? And the successful experiments could be emulated, copied by other states, and the unsuccessful experiments, you know, would be rejected by other states. But what we're seeing now is those sort of positive theories about how federalism works. So federalism in the U.S., we have two levels of government in the U.S. Constitution, the national government, the federal government, and the states. And compared to even other federalist countries around the world, Germany, Canada, Mexico, India, the U.S. puts a ton of authority at that lower level. And that was supposed to have all these benefits, one of which was Louis Brandeis's policy experiments, policy laboratories idea. But there's a ton of other ideas, like it protects against tyranny, right? We can customize policy to the wishes of the constituents and not have a one-size-fits-all sort of policy regime in the country. But all of those potential positive sort of effects of federalism have washed away in the contemporary period. And now federalism is leaving the U.S. Sort of under threat for democratic backsliding.
All right. So I want to give you almost pre-answered my second question, but I want to give a very remedial understanding, folks, a very remedial understanding of federalism and sort of like the idea behind why was our government federalist? And you're right about there's basically two different ways you can enter into a federalist government or something. But just walk us through that a little bit so we get the idea of like what and why Brandeis had at that time such a rosy outlook as to how this was going to go.
Exactly. So in the founding, in the debates around how to establish a constitution, move from a set of colonies to a unified country, right? In the aftermath of the Revolutionary War, there's this debate, so James Madison's proposing, let's have a unitary system of government with a really powerful national government, right? Not so much power to the states. Others, especially from small states and to some extent slave states, are saying, no, we need a lot of power in the states, right? We don't want the national government coming in, banning slavery, things like that. There's this big debate going on. So what they do is this compromise. They compromise between a system that, so there's some authority for the national government, some for the state governments, and they're not meant to encroach on each other. So that's federalism there. And then going forward, so in selling federalism for the U.S. Constitution, Madison and the Federalist Papers and a ton of other authors are writing, this is going to protect against tyranny. We don't want, different religious groups are in different states, right? They can customize policy to each other. And then Louis Brandeis in the 1930s, fast forward, has this other new, really positive idea of laboratories of democracy, of learning from each other across state lines, right? If there's a financial crisis like the Depression that Brandeis is living through, right? If a state is successful, other states can look. Like in the 2008 financial crisis, the idea is that Minnesota is doing a good job hiring back public sector workers, restarting its economy, raising tax revenue. Maybe Wisconsin, neighboring state, is going to look over and say, let's copy those successful things Minnesota did. But what we're finding now is if that were ever true, it's definitely not true now.
Right. And I imagine on some level, the reason why we had states to begin with was because the king didn't want a unified, maybe opposition to his minimal requirements of like, we just want to extract your resources. And if we can create different sort of regions that have different, sort of agendas, maybe there won't be something like some type of revolution at one point and everybody will get together. But the irony is it feels like that creation of maintaining separate sort of fiefdoms makes it that much harder to really have democracy function on some right. level. And we'll get into that. So what changed? Why was Brandeis so optimistic, and why did that change since that time? I mean, he's looking back and going like, you know, I guess you're 60 years out or so from 500,000 people dying because of the power of the states. But like, what was going on that he thought this was going to be helpful? But then going forward, what has changed?
Yeah. So Brandeis is coming at a time when it's like, we need policy experimentation. There's a depression. There's new technology coming in. There's world wars happening. We need to find new ways to experiment, to solve problems. Maybe the states can do these experiments. Then going forward, and then that actually in the mid 20th century after that, that kind of worked because the political parties, the Democratic and Republican parties, were decentralized, just like U.S. institutions, right? So U.S. institutions, all this authority at the lower level to customize, and the parties would kind of customize, like a Northern Republican was not like a Southern Republican. A Northern civil rights labor Democrat from Detroit is nothing like a Southern Dixiecrat segregationist Democrat, right? The party system kind of matches the institutional system. But then what we had since the 70s, and especially since the 90s and 2000s, you guys know this, the nationalization of fundraising in politics, the nationalization of media, and the rise of cable news and Fox News, rise of social media and the internet, destroying revenue of local newspapers. You have the nationalization of interest groups and sort of the rise of national sort of groups like, you know, on the right, the Koch Network, on the left, a group like MoveOn.org, able to coordinate the parties. And that what that does is make two national parties. But those two national parties are battling it out over this system that is super decentralized authority. And especially now on the Republican side, that's creating huge risks and also in general preventing the U.S. from solving national problems.
Well, so it seems like it flips with that. What the balance completely flips fairly quickly with the rise of national parties and fundraising, right? Where the laboratories, where the experimentation about messaging, hey, is it going to be Dr. Seuss? So now we've decided it's critical race theory. That happens on the media level and on the party apparatus level, and then the foot soldiers of the states, that's where it's implemented.
That's so well put, Emma. So like, I think critical race theory is a great example of how politics is so nationalized, right? This is happening in local school boards, state legislatures battling over this sort of national issue. These are not happening, you know, backlashes to critical race theory or new sort of trans rights issues aren't happening in places experiencing like a local influx of critical race theory that we're responding to, right?
Right.
They're responding to a national culture war and battling it out through these subnational institutions. And that's actually pretty dangerous. So right now what we're seeing overwhelmingly, this is so different than, so again, racial conflict is still so central to battles over American democracy. But the difference between Jim Crow and now is that Jim Crow racial politics were so regional. Battles over desegregating public goods in the South, battles over redistribution in the South between Southern black civil rights activists and Southern, you know, sort of white hegemonic segregationists, right? Now what we're seeing is, no, it's like from Wisconsin to North Carolina, right? We're seeing battles over democracy for the direction of the country.
You know, I mean, it's interesting because it does feel like, LBJ was correct, but underestimated the durability of the racial politics in this country. And when all of a sudden it was basically like, we're going to now polarize racial politics in the same way that, you know, like that increased the polarization of the party. I mean, that was not the purpose, but essentially everybody lined up based upon whether I wanted to give black people civil rights or not. And then all I can remember is, and I can't remember which author told us the stat, but it wasn't until like 2010 that, or even as late as 2008, maybe it was, 50% of non-college educated white people still believed that the Republican Party was more liberal in terms of race than the Democratic Party. And when Barack Obama got elected, that was like the final sorting out of all of those essentially Southern Democrats who realized, like, wait a second, the Democratic Party doesn't do what it did when my dad was a Democrat back in the day. They're the ones who are doing the phone slush fund or whatever it is. And so, so that takes us there. So
the Southern Deep South had Democratic state legislatures through the 2000s, like in Mississippi, Arkansas. Like, we don't quite remember that. They're conservative Democrats, but they were Democrats.
Right. And once that sort of like awareness became like, wait a second, this is not my dad's Democratic Party anymore. They're not Dixiecrats. They're not, fighting against, you know, sort of like, they're not trying to disenfranchise black voters anymore. We've got to move to the Republican Party. And that's basically what happened. So that's the trend. Let's talk about essentially like the you write that the three major crises that we went through, crises in 2020, really, I guess, put this trend or this development in relief. Why don't you talk about those three crises? Let's just start, I guess, with the pandemic policy.
Yeah. Is that still a thing? So the pandemic showed that decentralization, especially with comes with decentralized accountability. So for not for your listeners, not for you guys, some extent for me, I'm a PhD in poli sci. It's still hard to trace which politician is messing up and who is actually doing things that are helping my life. That's called retrospective voting. I'm looking back, like, am I better off than I was 4 years ago? Who do I reward? Who do I punish? That's really hard to do in the U.S. political system compared to unitary parliamentary systems like around the world. So in the U.S., it's reasonable to think. So you have Andrew Cuomo in New York, who's doing not a great job as governor in the pandemic. He's pointing to Trump saying, look at how bad Trump's doing. Trump's pointing to Cuomo, and a reasonable, like, you have to be pretty sophisticated to disentangle, like, who is actually messing up COVID in your area. Is it my mayor? Is it my governor? Is it my president? Is it Congress? That decentralizes accountability, whereas in most countries, right, you just saw this in the UK. If things are going bad, the party in national power is to blame. They change their leadership. They get voted out of office. Centralized accountability. And then all these coordination problems on top of that decentralized accountability, trying to secure PPE contracts, getting vaccines across states, right? The idea that some states are, you know, people are traveling interstate to spring break in Florida and coming back to other states. There's no tracing between these states. That sort of lack of coordination is built into the system on purpose, right? Through long-term sort of emphasis of authority and decentralization on the states. And that's really causing problems for solving national problems like a pandemic.
I mean, it was fascinating because at one point, the Trump administration was saying to the states, like, you're literally on your own to get the PPE or to get the ventilators or whatever it was. And you had states forming like their own little like mutual sort of aid packs with other states. And it's sort of just like, well, it's almost like you guys are a country in some way. Like, you, like, maybe you could do this with 50 states.
And that would be wild, man.
I mean, that was
my work.
That was like, I think one moment where I was like, this, what happens if we go down this road? We're going to have like three different states in the, like, or regional. I mean, it becomes even more less accountable on some level.
Exactly. And in my book, like, I traced quantitatively, statistically, since the 70s, the divergence in state policies across states. So now your state of residence matters much more than a generation ago for, you know, your health policies, whether you can get subsidized health insurance, your climate and sort of, you know, pollution policies, the gun rights or gun control you may have now with the Dobbs decision, your ability to legally obtain an abortion. So many things have divergent tax rates, labor relations, and your ability to organize or join a labor union. So many things have diverged. And now we see socioeconomic outcomes like mortality rates, preventable deaths really diverging as well. And that's a real change from when we had through the mid 20th century, through the New Deal, through the civil rights movement, through the 70s, you had convergence between states with states becoming more similar.
That's that is a little bit scary. I mean, let's talk about the, okay, so we had the pandemic, and then we had policing. Let's talk about what that revealed in terms of the, I guess, the failure of our type of federalism, maybe.
Yeah, so, I mean, it seems 2020 seems so long ago now, but George Floyd was murdered. You know, we saw that on video. One of the largest peaceful protest movements in U.S. history happened after that in response. But what we really saw through that period, and then we see a backlash to that Black Lives Matter movement and sort of a resurgence of sort of tough on crime politics and a sort of crime panic now over the past year.
And the anti-CRT stuff is also,
exactly,
right?
I mean, but what you see is policing in terms of political inputs, like what social movements and voters are saying, right? It changes hugely, huge changes over the past few years. But policing and incarceration stay really, really, really static. So that's an insulated policy area where it's really hard for democracy to get a hold of what their police departments are doing. Basically, now police departments are sort of mini cartels that have their own source of authority, and it's really hard even for reformist minded mayors. So I used to go, you know, debate with myself, is the reason policing never gets reformed, is it because Democratic urban politicians and mayors and governors, they come in and they say they want to reform policing, but they deep down don't really want to, and they're faking the funk? Or is it like they actually their hands are tied and they really have no source of local power politically to reform policing? And I think it's the latter now, like seeing the de Blasio administration in New York, for example, really campaign on reforming the NYPD and be unsuccessful again is actually a very common story. And that's, again, because the U.S. decentralizes policing. In the Constitution, police powers are a state level authority, which is then delegated by states to cities. In other countries, there's much more like sort of military hierarchy, nationalization of the police force. And imagine if the president was like, oh, I wish I could tell the military to like move to a different country and invade someplace and not invade this other place. But my hands are tied. Like they're on their own and I have no ability to influence their behavior. But that's what policing is like when you see mayors every time an unarmed person is killed by the police to be like, wow, like another tragedy. I wish I could help. And it's like, you're the legal commander in chief of this police force. So there's a huge difference in most other developed democracies with how policing authority is sort of delegated.
But doesn't there's a paradox here, right? Because you're writing about the almost like the de-evolution of national power to the states, but there's also sort of like a parallel thing that's happening with police forces where their power is growing relative to the state authorities or the local authorities that are supposedly having oversight. Like they're running in a completely sort of like different track almost, it feels like.
I'm gonna steal that, Sam. That's insightful. That's exactly right.
And it's the absence of national authority on the police that again can't make up for the dynamic between the local authorities and the local police, I guess. So okay, and so and then the third element is really, I guess, it may in some ways like a summation of the first two, which is that it is fundamentally undermining our democracy. Like, if there's no national or local control of the police, like, they're like, who's like, what's
going
on?
What do you know? They behave like a mob. It's so shocking.
Right.
They behave like a criminal enterprise.
And, then you talk about sort of like how things have changed from state to state, but also the relationship between the people living in that state and how things have changed is also off. Talk about that dynamic.
Exactly. So this last crisis is sort of one of electoral democracy, of free and fair elections and responsiveness to majorities and the mass public in the U.S. So a decline of democracy. And that goes along with this delegation over the past generation of national power to the states, greater leeway for the states to customize. And then what I show statistically, again, is especially over the past 20 years and especially since 2010, there's been huge divergence. A huge gap has arisen between states in terms of how easy it is to vote, the fairness of their districting in terms of gerrymandering, how responsive they are in passing policy compared to what the public of their state actually wants in surveys, and in terms of sort of election integrity and sort of election vote counting and such. So again, the U.S. super, super unique, the only real developed democracy to put all that authority over democratic institutions, districting, vote counting, who's eligible to vote and not, all done at that lower level unit. And just zooming out a second, if you guys remember after 2016, everybody was saying, like, thank God for federalism. Trump can't capture all these state election administrations and every county election administrator is not going to flip. And if it was all centralized in D.C., we'd be, you know, we'd be done for. We'd have an autocrat in power. And while that's like narrowly true, like once a would-be autocrat's in Washington, D.C., you don't want to like give them all the election administration. But before that, over long stretches of time, the 2010s decline of democracy in the states and states regulate elections from like local dog catcher up to president, that has enabled and empowered and made more likely a would-be autocrat taking national power and now has the potential to essentially subvert or steal the 2024 presidential election, as you guys have talked about on the show.
Well, because we also have the results that we're going to reap from the Supreme Court hearing the case on state legislatures having more jurisdiction over federal elections and determining how those votes are counted and in what way. I mean, we don't know what the scope of the ruling is going to be, but it's fair to assume that they're going to side with these Republican state legislatures. Like, what does that portend for the decline of our democracy and how someone like, say, Trump could take over again in 24?
Yeah, so, you know, that's a step beyond what I was just talking about in terms of all this voter suppression and biased gerrymandering. That has real effects, right? So that means gerrymandering, for example, makes it so an anti-abortion minority of voters can set a majority of a state legislature, right, and pass an abortion ban. That's really meaningful. It's not at the level of Jim Crow or slavery, right? Those were state laws that were a bigger deal even than this. But what you're talking about, the independent state legislatures doctrine in the Supreme Court, which could be ruled on, and I'm no big city lawyer, but like I think you're right, Emma. There's a good chance they'll pass it and say essentially state legislatures can choose which presidential candidate to give their electoral college votes, regardless of what voters say, meaning a single swing state legislature could essentially throw a presidential election. And in 2024, that would produce a real constitutional crisis. And that would be a whole new front on this exact where we started, right? Using state level decentralized authority, right, at the lower level for national political project for national power over the national direction of the country there.
You'd mentioned about abortion in terms of and some of these other issues where you have the polling showing that people's views on these things have remained static, even though the sort of like state by state regime of these things have sort of flipped in many respect. There was a statistic that you had in there. I think it was 14 states. There are 14 states where abortion will be restricted or banned, where the majority of the population does not want that. But there is no reverse. Will you just tease that out and articulate it better than I have?
So I, along with Chris Warshaw, another political scientist at George Washington University, we're looking at public opinion towards abortion in the states and really like banning abortion essentially fully or except for life of the mother. And about 41 states and 61% of the whole country supports legal abortion in this sort of definition. And that's been totally stable over the past generation, right? Unlike same-sex marriage, which like was becoming hugely popular culturally, and then the Supreme Court, as it becomes very popular, legalizes it nationally, right? Whereas here, this is like a stable majority support, and the Supreme Court takes a ruling that really goes against public opinion this way, gives more leeway to the states, and this is a classic pattern in American democratic backsliding, going back to Reconstruction, the end of Reconstruction, and and other times is the Supreme Court says, listen, states, you can do whatever you want. States then sort of backslide democracy, do things against public opinion or restrict democracy. And then Congress decides whether to step up and, like, you know, get their asses in gear and block that and standardize, create floors or baseline rules for the states. And they often don't. Right. So right now, what you're seeing with abortion is you're exactly right. There's no state with an anti-abortion majority, or there's no state with an anti-abortion majority that's not going to ban abortion. Right. But there are a number of states with pro-choice majorities that are going to ban abortion. The Kansas referendum is an exception there, where the voters stepped up and said, no, we don't want this abortion ban. So it's going to be 13 states, and that may be eventually more. But in the meantime, we already see news stories of how this is affecting pregnant women and families and so forth. This is really meaningful stuff. But gerrymandering in the 2010s set mathematical records in terms of partisan gerrymandering. There's various types of Jim Crow racial gerrymandering that are different. But in partisan gerrymandering, states like Wisconsin and North Carolina, this is not like me just exaggerating. They set mathematical records for like how many votes it would take above majority of the state's voters to get a Democratic state legislative majority. And then those gerrymandered Republican state legislative majorities are able to pass unpopular policies like an abortion ban without getting voted out of office. That's hugely problematic for basic democratic functioning and being responsive to majorities in your state.
You just touched on the Supreme Court, and maybe this is sort of coming close to full circle, you know, with Brandeis. But how much of this, how much of this is a function of the Supreme Court? Like, you know, because I, you know, for me, 2000 was an incredibly anti-democratic moment for the court, and we just continued to see on some level that sort of the court inhibiting the federal government and empowering the states. And is this phenomena, like, have we been through, I mean, it sort of feels like we've been through this era late in Reconstruction, maybe just after Reconstruction, through the time until we get to Brandeis, essentially, that there was this re-entrenchment, I guess, of states' rights, which, as we've articulated, at the end of the day, the primary reason why you would want states' rights was, like, we want our slaves and other states don't want us to have slaves.
Right. So the pattern is pretty clear. So there used to be this debate after the Warren Court, right, of the sort of late, you know, post-war, late 20th century, did Brown v. Board of Education, right? They did a bunch of rights for women, some labor protections and environmental protections. It was a progressive court, and that sort of warped some historians and social science opinions into thinking, okay, the Supreme Court is this, like, you know, can be this hopeful story. Sorry, I froze right there. The Supreme Court rather is what historians call the hollow hope. So the hope that the Supreme Court is going to sort of support democracy, be responsive to public opinion, empower through civil and labor rights and things like that, Americans, that on balance is absolutely not the case. And we see that again. This is more normal times for the court. And the sort of 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s was the weird off time of the Warren Court. So, yeah, judicial supremacy, it's called in the U.S., you know, going back to the 19th century in the U.S., that's, again, unique. The idea that the court can actually throw out congressional or state level legislation and say it's not constitutional. They get to decide that. And, you know, they're appointed life terms, Supreme Court justices. That's also very unique and probably not the best sort of small D democratic system when you look around the world.
It feels like a weird time where there's been multiple books or assessments of various aspects of the post-world era, which are all starting to come to the conclusion of, like, that was actually not the norm.
Yeah.
And that was actually an anomaly in our history. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that line up. It's considered the least polarized time in terms of our politics. Like, people were complaining about the Republicans and the Democrats being too similar at that time. Piketty's argument is that the Great Compression, as some people call it, the flattening of income inequality, was again an anomaly in our history. And this was a time, obviously, where the Warren Court was basically diffusing power, I guess. I mean, on some level, making the country more democratic. How do we get more of that anomaly, or at least parts of that? How do we return to that?
Yeah, man, that's the question of our times. And I think one of the most underemphasized thing, it's becoming more emphasized, but I think the importance of the labor movement is so underemphasized in so many sort of contemporary takes about what is to be done for American democracy. And I say this not just because you talked about, you know, the importance of a broad middle class and some form of socioeconomic equality in society. Labor unions helped build that, right? But it also channeled sort of, it was the main organizational vehicle for mass politics, and it prevented a sort of culture war politics in many ways. I have a line of research with a professor at Princeton, Paul Frymer, where we look statistically, becoming a labor union member, joining a labor union, or more accurately, like having a labor union, like, organize or join you as a white worker, makes you less racially resentful and more racially solidaristic. So we have all these debates about, strategies for the left and liberals, Democratic Party, is it race or class? You know, how do we thread this needle, identity politics, or go after working class white voters, blah, blah, blah. And it turns out like a lot of this is linked, and the labor movement was actually some of the main organizations that set the agenda in the North for civil rights. They fused sort of civil rights politics with labor and economic justice politics starting in the 1930s. Going forward, they played a role in the Democratic Party becoming the party of civil rights. And then now the sort of bright spots in American politics are like the little Gen Z kids organizing at Starbucks and Amazon and things like that across racial lines, building identities, especially for white workers that are, you know, not just, oh, my identity is at the top of the racial and gender hierarchy, but an identity of like, I'm a worker, I'm pulling in the same direction as people across racial groups. That is so, so, so crucial and so underemphasized. And the Democratic Party has neglected that, since the 1990s, especially. But then even now, when you see unified blue states like Virginia prior to this last gubernatorial election, they did not end their anti-labor laws on the books, like right to work laws. Whereas in the Midwest, the Republican Party, when they took over Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio and so forth, they passed these anti-labor laws, increased culture war politics and really helped the Republican Party win elections. That's statistically extremely demonstrated. Democratic Party elites don't sort of push the advantage quite in the same way.
How much of that, too, I wonder, is the absence of labor increases corporate power, just definitionally, right? And when you increase corporate power, just my experience of having grown up in a city of 160,000 people and lived for a substantial period of time in a city of closer to like 6,000 people, is that like the difference between a 6,000-person city and a 160,000-person city is like how big the corporation, any given corporation needs to be to basically corrupt the politics locally. And I wonder if on all levels of our government, the absence of labor in terms of like disciplining, the capitalist class and corporations in terms of like, you know, just inhibiting the amount of profit they can take and essentially political power they have relative, you know, as a function of their of their money and their and just their power over any given workforce, whether that also doesn't contribute to this. Because it seems to me that like part of what has been happening at the same time as all these other factors that we've discussed is you have like organizations like ALEC,
right,
and that are basically set up by corporate interests to align and nationalize, to sort of replicate politics. You mentioned Wisconsin, you know, I think what Walker did in Wisconsin in terms of that was straight out of ALEC's playbook. And they started there, and no coincidence, it was, you know, also the Koch brothers' backyard, essentially. And they ran this as like a test pilot.
That's so right. And I got to make the federalism decentralization point there. It's really hard for ordinary voters who are not organized in labor unions or community organizations or, you know, progressive churches and, you know, religious organizations. Organizations help individuals understand what's going on in politics. It's really hard to trace at the state and local level who is corrupt, who is not responsive to the will of the constituents. There's not much media coverage of it. So groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, can present model bills to sort of what are sleepy state legislatures, which don't have much staff or, you know, sort of support or media coverage on them, you know, pass a wave of state level policies when they get the sort of opportunity because their party's in power. That is really a brilliant move that has paid off long-term political dividends, what's called policy feedbacks in political science, when you pass a policy and then it affects future politics. So, you know, that 2010 win and helping to destroy labor and then gerrymander your state legislature, you make it really, really hard for the other coalition to, you know, fairly take back power, even if the voters want that. So that's a huge deal. And then in terms of corporate power, it's true. It's an analogous point, kind of like the policing point. Corporations have a much easier time capturing a state or local government, right, than they do an entire country's government when everybody's – not that there's not corruption in Congress and, like, people – you know, we just saw Sinema, you know, dealing with some financial industry donors. Like, this really happens. But at the lower levels of government, it's much, much – money goes a lot farther, right? It's right. A lot easier to buy people.
And it's more comprehensive because you just don't have as many sort of like different lawmakers with individual sort of agendas.
Right.
Kristen Sinema might want to save the hedge funders, but there's somebody sitting to her left or right who wants to save like the investment banks. Mm. And so they fight. Right. You know, it's they. I mean, sadly, that's basically it. It's fascinating and a little bit scary. Jacob Grumbach, the book is Laboratories Against Democracy, How National Parties Transform State Politics.
That. I got it.
That's
yeah, we even covered up the Brandeis quote there.
Oh, there you go. That's perfect. And we'll put a link to that at majority.fm in our podcast and YouTube description. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Great to see you guys.
Thanks. Yeah. All right, folks. That's it for the free half of the show anyways.
Bye-bye.
But there's still more fun to come.
Yes.
And thus, we call the second half the fun half. It is the hot and humid, sweaty fun half.
It's way better here today. Even if the AC's on high, I feel much better. Much better.
Than it was yesterday?
No, than it was before.
Oh, pre-air conditioning.
Pre-R2-D2.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like now is when it's just starting to become sweltering as
yes.
opposed to an hour ago.
Right.
We cannot keep the air conditioning going past the start of the show.
It's actually just off now.
Oh, no.
Oh,
no,
okay.
It's on just that.
It's
80,
on, but we have it at 82 degrees, which is essentially off.
Basically off, yeah.
Because
but, well, people who watch Friday will have
yeah, this
be aware.
Is, yes. We overload.
And what do we have it on then? 78, and that's when the power shut
79,
down?
I think.
79. Yeah. There we go. Cannot dip below 80 in this office.
No, it cannot, or the power goes off. And so this is what we do for you, ladies and gentlemen. And that is why when you become a member, every time you do, our internal temperature drops by a fraction of a degree. And we thank you for that.
Yes.
Join themajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Let me read a... oh, my God. Yeah, like I just like looked over at some of the IMs we've been getting. Like people,
what are
saying,
they?
Well, just like lame duck Charles says, Sam, did you really need to sabotage Emma's show on Friday? Just accept the fact she's the star now.
Mm, good
and
point.
And then there's other stuff like,
can you verify your whereabouts?
I mean, I was in the power room downstairs in the building.
It's just odd that like
I always
fans,
hang out.
It's just
I'm
odd
not.
That our fan server had a problem. It was strange.
Yeah. I mean, I was. I know exactly where I was. I was in the electric room downstairs in the building
with a big shears,
a laptop, and
the wrench doing interpretive dance,
and just tying up the loose ends on a phishing scam I had to get into the back end of the server.
That's drama between us, folks. Some of these YouTube.
Emma, you got to stop clicking those betting links.
Exactly. There was another. I am like. Oh, here it is. Daredevil, what safeguards do you have at the Sam? What safeguards do you have at the Majority Report to prevent an insurrection? Emma is slowly building and accumulating institutional power, from nicknaming the days of the week to having her own merch.
I know. Well, the thing about it is that our institutions will save us, so don't worry about it.
Dear Majority Report crew, writes listener Ryan, longtime listener, first time emailer. Just want to write in and say thank you for everything you do. I've been listening to you for several years now, and you've been instrumental in helping me crystallize my political thoughts and motivations. I also wanted to let you know that my master's thesis, Analyzing the Effect of Money in Politics and Elite Influence on Federal Education Policy, was recently accepted for publication with honors.
Mm.
Michael Brooks, too, had an indelible impact on the way I've come to interact with the world, and so I dedicated my work in part to his memory. That's sweet. Rest in power, left is best, Ryan. Thank you, Ryan. Appreciate the email.
One step close to hegemony.
There you go. Matt, let me just remind you about Just Coffee. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off for all your coffee needs. People can try the Majority Report blend, or even, if they must, the WTF blend that Mark Maron shills.
Hmm.
But there's also a lot of other great flavors to the coffee. With that said, Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, thanks for that reminder about the coffee. for patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning, David Griscom put together a history of the populist movement. He did part one. It's funny, like, we're trying to do a little bit of these more scripted video essay type of things, and you realize, like, that's quite a lot of work. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning. Let's let Dave feel like it was worth it. And also, Ben Spielberg, we're going to be talking about the infrastructure, or the Inflation Reduction Act, and we're going to be dwelling a little bit more on where the half a loaf went to. Like, I'm willing to grant that this is half a loaf, but let's talk a little bit about, at some point you keep getting half a loaf, so you wonder where the other half is going. So we're going to be talking to Ben about that. And if David and I owe Jayapal an apology for making her the bump steer of the year last year. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. Show will be tomorrow night at 8 Eastern, our new day on Tuesdays.
Now, wait a second. You obviously can't tell me, right? Because that would be a spoiler alert. But you guys had made her the bum steer
because of the failure of Build Back Better.
Because of separating the
yeah. So now we're going to reassess that strategy, and maybe we were wrong, maybe we weren't. We're going to do a little bit of accountability.
I don't know about that, but I guess I got to tune in.
Well, which way do you?
Well, I still think that. That may have been a problem, frankly.
I mean, that's why we invited Ben on, because I think he still thinks it was, too.
Well, there you go. All right.
Spoiler alert.
We just spoiled the whole show. Folks, see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun. Nomi Keen.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon!
Fun. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
All right, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go start watching.
Who libertarians? They're so stupid though. Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$6.543 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this. Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes, it's satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun down, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
Folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.